gun laws in Norway today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Norway experienced a mass shooting 5 years ago. The semi-automatic weapon used was purchased legally. Sounds familiar, right?
There's a high percentage of gun ownership in Norway, but those guns are used mainly 1 week in the year during the hunting of elks, and the rest of the year is locked down and stored.
Also, Dago Bailon came out twice, once as an undocumented immigrant and again to his parents.
I sat them down and told them that it had been 23 years of lying and suffering and that I wanted to wake up the next day feeling a complete person. And that meant that I needed to tell them that I was gay.
Plus, where are palm trees not trees? Find out today on The World. Glad you could be here today. The mass shooting in Orlando has reopened the heated debate in this country about what to do with guns. It's also made many Americans feel frustrated that we're still having that conversation. And that got us thinking about what happened in Norway nearly 5 years ago. Anders Breivik carried out two attacks, taking 77 lives. First, he planted a car bomb that went off in Oslo. Then he went on a shooting rampage on the island of Utøya, just outside Oslo. That's where Breivik used a semi-automatic rifle and killed 69 people, mostly young campers. Norway is known for high gun ownership, but also strict gun laws. So did the massacre in 2011 change anything? Åsne Seierstad of Oslo looked into that for her book, One of Us, the story of Anders Breivik and the massacre in Norway. She says Breivik bought all his guns legally.
But he had to go through more measures than you do have to do in America. So he had to be a member of a pistol club, and he had to do a certain, I think it was 50 hours of shooting in order to be able to buy a pistol. And then he also had to be a member of the Hunting Association of Norway in order to be able to buy the rifles and that ammunition. So he is a planner. So he planned this, he became member of those organizations, and then he bought everything legally.
So he went through all of that. Were Norwegians saying afterwards, look, we've got all these systems set up, a vetting process that's pretty strong, and he still got through. So if people want to kill, they're going to kill.
Well, yes. What the debate was after when it comes to guns, what the fact that he used a semi-automatic rifle, and there were debate in the parliament whether we should not allow those kind of guns to be used. But then it was a protest from the hunting association saying that it's more humane if the animal runs away to be able to put your gun on semi-automatic. So nothing has changed.
So no changes to any gun laws at all after Utøya?
No, but it's also like we have quite restrictive laws and we have very, very few gun accidents and gun murders. As you say, yes, there's a high percentage of gun ownership in Norway, but those guns are used mainly 1 week in the year during the hunting of elks season or hunting of these specific birds that they hunt, and the rest of the year is locked down and stored. It's not lying around. People don't have them in their cars, in their homes, in their bedrooms. So we can't really blame guns for the very few murders we have in Norway.
Are you saying that Norway focuses more on the individual? Like, I'm just wondering, since 2011, how many other mass shootings have there been in Norway?
None. And also, I think for you in the US, it seems like there's, in some states, there are almost no laws. Like, how can just ordinary people have their guns lying around in their cars? They're shot by their kids. It can't be compared. It's too total different cultures when it comes to guns.
How much was mental health part of the discussion after the Utøya shootings?
Oh, that was a big topic up to the court case, and still it is, because of course the main question we asked ourselves, is he a madman or is he a political terrorist? Those are two different things. And the court ended up judging him as a political terrorist, and he's convicted of murder and he's in for probably for the rest of his life for those terror attacks that he committed. But he's not sane. Like, he got the diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder, but that doesn't exempt you from being punished. You're still accountable for your crime. You know what you did. You knew you had a choice. You knew you'd stop. It's not like you were under psychosis or anything like that.
You know, as I speak with you, it really feels like in Norway there is a system for dealing with guns, for dealing with people who are suspected of some kind of mental instability. Bottom line, what is different in Norway that means mass shootings are less frequent than the U.S.?
The way we look at guns. It's like even the police has not been armed in Norway. I mean, people in the U.S. would say, well, isn't that scary that your police is not armed? Well, when the police is not armed, the drug dealers are not armed. The criminals are not armed because no one is armed. So it's like that's why we have so few murders. People wouldn't even dream of having, regular people wouldn't dream of having a gun in their house for protection. That would be, I would see that as a very rare case if anyone had that. No one I know.
So Åsne, from your perch in Norway, when you look at the U.S. and you see the number of mass shootings here, practically one a day this year, what's your suggestion as a Norwegian on what the U.S. ought to do to stop this madness?
I would say restrictions on guns.
Åsne Seierstad is the author of One of Us, a story of Anders Breivik and the massacre in Norway. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Always interesting to hear how another country deals with the issues raised by a mass shooting. But the attack on the Pulse nightclub in Orlando has done more than just revive our national gun debate. It's also opened up a national conversation about issues like sexual identity and LGBT rights. So I want you to meet Dago Bailon. He was born in Mexico, crossed the desert when he was a kid to be with his mom in Arizona. Dago was undocumented for years until a program created by the Obama administration temporarily protected kids from deportation. In a way, that's when he was finally able to come out as an undocumented immigrant. But there's something else about Dago. He also came out of the closet, so he knows what it's like to come out twice in a way, and he's helped a lot of people in Arizona accept both realities in their lives. Dago Bailon joins me now from Phoenix. If you would, give us a snapshot of the two times you came out, if we can call it that. Let's start with your own understanding of your status as a resident here. You're 29 now. When did you realize that you were in the U.S. illegally, and how did that feel to you?
It was junior year in high school, and I wanted to be part of the academic decathlon. And the economics teacher had planned a trip to Hawaii. I was really excited, and me and my friends were really excited to be part of this trip. But we needed to apply, so the teacher gave me a form to sign up. And the first thing that I saw when I saw that form was that I needed a social security number. So I realized at that moment that I was not going to be able to be part of the program and that there was going to be more barriers to come.
And how did that feel to you at the time?
It felt like I was the only person that was going through this. And I actually, I just kind of shut down.
The Obama program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, has kept you from being deported. At some point in your life, you also announced to your parents that you were gay. How did they react to that, and how old were you?
Yeah, I came out when I was 23. My parents didn't take it lightly. I had to sit them down and really talk to them. I had asked many of my friends that were part of the LGBT community the way that they came out, and many of them told me, well, I texted them, I left a letter, and when I came back home, they already knew. And so I was really trying to figure out different ways for me to talk to my parents. And I realized that they were really important in my life and that I wanted them to be part of my life. And I sat them down and told them that it had been 23 years of lying and suffering and that I wanted to wake up the next day feeling a complete person. And that meant that I needed to tell them that I was gay. And my mom cried and my dad pretended not to hear. But in the end, my mom said, what kind of parents would we be if we didn't support things that you do?
As a young boy, I know you grew up in a very small town in Mexico. What exposure did you have to homosexuality there? Do you remember?
I had no idea what the word LGBT meant. I had no idea about gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans people. I just knew that at home I had an uncle. I had an aunt now. She is a trans woman who came to the U.S. also, but because of her transition, her name was associated with people who were part of the LGBT community. So in my town, a lot of the times, they didn't use derogatory words, but they did call people by my uncle's name. So if they wanted to be disrespectful to somebody of the LGBT community, they would call you Amancio, which is my aunt's name.
Hmm. Your work as an activist, though, I'm really curious to know how these two challenges of being gay and undocumented in the United States, how you address both and how these challenges intersect.
The way that we started doing the work was like really looking at what it meant for undocumented LGBT people to be LGBT. And we would have double coming out forums where we would talk about the similarities and the differences of coming out of the shadows and the closets, but also like what it meant when somebody that was undocumented came out and didn't have access to basic public services. Because in Arizona in 2004, voters took that away, which meant that some people and some of our members were going to be left homeless if they were to come out of the closet because they couldn't go to a shelter because they were undocumented. They couldn't have access to a doctor if they needed anything, no mental health. So we started really seeing that the immigration part was not just an immigrant issue, but also an LGBT issue because it also placed specific barriers in our health as LGBT community.
Dago, tell me the name of your organization, your activist group.
Transport Pueblo.
Transport Pueblo. So I gather your group also works with the parents of gay youth. Is that easy, considering many are pretty Catholic?
You know, for us, Transport Pueblo works with parents because we understand that when we come out of the closet, also our parents are forced out of the closet with us, right? And a lot of the times we just go on with our lives and we forget to really take the time to process with our parents. And so we have a family acceptance program in which we educate parents about identities. And the curriculum that we have is rooted in our migrant and people of color experiences because we understand that we have to take a different way in talking to our parents. And for us, what that means is understanding that our parents, there is a lot to work with. There is a lot of love, and we have to start from there.
What about the feeling that you had with both acts, announcing and owning the fact that you're gay and announcing and kind of realizing that you are undocumented? I mean, what was similar about these two things and what was different?
You know, the similarity was that those butterflies that you get in the stomach and also that uncertainty. When I started organizing in 2006 against Proposition 300 in Arizona that took away all of my scholarships because I was undocumented and I was going public about my status, I felt uncertain. I felt like I was going to lose a lot of my friends. I felt like alone again, right? And when I came out of the closet, it was the same feeling, those butterflies that I thought had gone away had not.
Are all the butterflies gone on both counts now, pretty much?
You know, the butterflies don't ever go away. As LGBT people, we come out every day, and every day that we come out in different places, we are always putting our lives on the line.
Dago Bailon, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you all for having me.
We also have a video of Dago directed by Juan Frites Mora that has more of his story, as well as some of his drag performance in Phoenix. We've posted that on our Tumblr. That's at pritheworld.tumblr.com. And here's a quick preview of a story we'll have for you tomorrow. It's about a filmmaker who moved her family to Jerusalem. She wanted her children to grow up where Arabs and Jews live together.
And I wanted my kids to learn Arabic and Hebrew and English. And I wanted my kids to have a complexity and understand that in a place where for so long they've been proclaiming only one narrative, there were actually many narratives, and especially two main narratives, which was both the Jewish and the Arab. And those two narratives contradicted one another.
But that move to Jerusalem and her movie did not turn out the way she planned. Her story tomorrow. You're listening to The World. These days, if I were to say Yemen, I doubt you're thinking, honey, Yemen doesn't get much attention anyway, and when it does, it's about the war that continues to rage there. But one of the many casualties of that war is the country's venerable honey trade. It's in critical condition now. But as reporter Ali Budner found out, some Yemenis are keeping up the tradition from thousands of miles away. Here's the story of one man doing that in Oakland, California.
Some people know Khalid al-Magafi as the bee rescuer, and recently I saw why. We're at a home in the Bay Area with a problem. There's a beehive in the rafters. Al-Magafi saws out a chunk of the ceiling, and out come thousands of honeybees.
Look at it.
They dart toward the windows and cling to the curtains in clumps.
I'm smoking them now, but the honeycomb is sticking out, you see?
He then softly vacuums the bees into a bucket. Al-Magafi also doesn't look like your typical beekeeper. No gloves or big white suit. This 52-year-old father of four just wears pants and a button-down shirt. No protection. He says getting stung once or twice gives him energy. Plus, he's worked with bees since he was a kid, back in Yemen.
Most of my childhood was with my dad, watching him raising the bees.
He learned from his dad, but also wanted to see how beekeeping worked elsewhere.
I heard a lot about the agriculture in California, beekeeping and farming and all that stuff.
In 1986, Al-Magafi flew to San Francisco. He was 22 and wanted to go to college, but couldn't afford it. So he worked at a gas station and looked up beekeeping in the phone book, where he found an elderly man doing bee removals.
He was the only one in Yellow Pages. I called him.
The man became his mentor, and before he died, he gave Al-Magafi his bee removal tools for free. Al-Magafi started creating his own hives, but then a mysterious die-off decimated them. As he built things back up, his dad in Yemen gave him some advice.
My dad kept telling me, you know, you can open a store there. People respect bees and honey. I kept, you know, going back and forth, you know, busy, busy, busy. And finally I said, I'm going to give it a shot and open one.
His store, the Bee Healthy Honey Shop in Oakland, is a hit, offering honey from all over. And when he can get it, he sells Yemen's coveted sitter honey. He says it tastes like perfume. His products are also displayed in these hexagonal shelves, like a giant honeycomb. He got the idea from Yemen.
Over there, you know, every corner has a honey shop. Like here, every corner has a liquor store. If you go to the shops, it's just like you're going inside the museum. The floor, the walls, everything, like you are inside a beehive.
But now, maybe that's getting destroyed.
Yeah, and now everything is going the wrong way, you know.
Yemen's civil war is tearing his country apart. Thousands killed, millions displaced.
People are struggling, trying to make it, you know, God with them, you know.
Yemen's honey industry has also tanked. Al-Magafi's brother has scaled his bee business way back. But it's what happened to his father a decade ago that hurts Al-Magafi most. His dad had left the military because of the corruption he saw and raised bees instead. But then a tribal leader wanted his land, and Al-Magafi says the man killed his father to get it.
He lived a simple life, bees and trees, until they shot him, and they killed him over his small garden, believe it or not. That's what hurts a lot.
He thinks about this here in California as he puts buzzing bees into a bucket, like coaxing a genie back into the bottle. Al-Magafi's work is also spiritual. He's Muslim, and the Quran says God told bees how to make honey. For Al-Magafi, they're proof of a higher being.
You see how they dance, how they collect the honey, how they work. You feel deep inside there is a creator, created all those things and created us and the whole globe. Yeah, perfect.
It troubles him that some can see bees, like Islam, as dangerous.
They benefit us for pollination, for medicinal, which is honey, for the environment. If it wasn't for them, we'll be stuck. They do all this for nothing.
And when he thinks about the war in Yemen, he remembers his father and how he took an old box from his military days, once filled with bullets, and converted it into a beehive. Al-Magafi hopes that soon more people in Yemen will do that too. For The World, Ali Budner, Oakland, California.
Next Wednesday is the last day of school in my city, a relief for kids, a time to close the books, on their least favorite subjects anyway, which brings me to our next story. Imagine the government forcing you to study in a language that you didn't want to learn. Well, 40 years ago, students in Soweto, South Africa, faced that dilemma in a very stark way. The apartheid regime decreed that all students be taught in Afrikaans, the language of the country's white minority. Thousands of black Soweto students protested in the streets. South African police responded with brutality. Hundreds of young demonstrators were killed. Our colleagues at the BBC spoke recently with a survivor of that Soweto uprising, along with two current Soweto students.
My name is Bani Khalibwe Mokhatle. I'm 62 years old. 1976, I was attending school in Soweto, Morris Isaacson. That morning, when the police started shooting, and hear the cracking of bullets, of gunshots, and the smoke coming from their guns, and also the screaming of the young ones, the kids, it was just pandemonium. On June 16, we're standing here with my friend Hastings, and the police were over there, and then that's when they shot at us, and my friend Hastings was killed right here. I saw him fall next to me, and when I looked, I just saw blood oozing from his forehead and his eyes sort of turning, and that's when I realized that he's dead. And that's when we started taking stones to hit at the police, and they started opening fire on us.
My name is Nobuntu Dlamini. I'm 18 years old, turning 19 in just 2 days. I am from Soweto in a township called Dube. The emotions that I feel when I remember the June 16, 40 years ago, are very heartbreaking, sad, because they fought for what they believed in and what was going to benefit us in the end. If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't even be doing this interview.
At the time, it was anger which was charging you. It was anger which was making you to face the bullet. It was anger which was saying, now enough is enough. I'm going to fight these people.
My name is Esso and I'm 17. I'm from Soweto. If June 16 had never happened, I think it would still be taught in Afrikaans, and a lot of us would fail because it's not our mother language or mother tongue.
It was worth it, because now we've got our freedom, but we have not reached the freedom which we wanted, because we thought at this stage that we'll be having free education, equal education, and compulsory education.
We're still in a fight to get proper education because a lot of students come from poor backgrounds and can't afford education, so the struggle continues.
Soweto students Esona Mthinsi and Nobuntu Dlamini. You also heard Barney Mogatle, a survivor of the 1976 Soweto uprising. They were speaking there with our colleagues at the BBC. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Bhutan is a small country, but it had a big problem with stray dogs.
They're along the highways, they're in front of every gas station, the police station, hanging out by people's houses. You're stepping over them on the sidewalks. They're everywhere.
How Bhutan fixed its stray dog problem, that's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It looks like Disney, it sounds like Disney, but this time it's Communist Party approved. Yep, today Disney opened its first theme park in mainland China. It's on the outskirts of Shanghai. Now, the move makes perfect business sense. The target market is some 330 million potential visitors living within a three-hour drive of the city. Jonathan Kamen was on hand for the opening of Shanghai Disneyland. He's Asia correspondent for the LA Times. So I gather you've put on your mouse ears, Jonathan, and joined the crowd. What does this place look like?
Absolutely. Yeah, I spent the last 2 days at the park, and walking around, it felt like an authentically Disney theme park. They've got their Magic Castle. They have a number of sort of themed areas of the park. There's a sort of rainforest-themed adventure section. There's a futuristic section with a Tron-themed roller coaster. There's a Disneyland castle and, you know, all of the costume Disney characters. It feels very, very Disney with a very Chinese clientele.
Today, I gather it was raining, but people turned out, and what did they think?
Yeah, there were plenty of people there. I think they were generally happy. There have been some complaints in the run up to the opening about a few matters. The lines on the rides are long. People have been waiting 2-3 hours to get on the top attractions. And the food prices. So the food is one of the major selling points of the park. That's how they're casting it. They've made a point of selling mostly Chinese and Asian food, but also some sort of inventive Disney-style fusion dishes. They have one that their public relations people have repeatedly harped on as a Peking duck flavored pizza in the shape of a Mickey Mouse with scallions and cucumbers. It didn't work for me, but apparently it's selling quite well.
Kind of weird. I hear that Disney had to make a lot of concessions to the Chinese officials, things like having a Communist Party approved Mickey Mouse. How much influence has the government had over development of this park?
Well, when you're walking through the park, it's tough to see the actual Chinese sort of elements. You know, where you see the most influence from the Communist Party is behind the scenes on a more corporate level. So, you know, in speaking with PR people from Disney before the opening, they keep on sort of harping on this tagline for the park, which is authentically Disney, distinctly Chinese. You hear this over and over again from their staff members, from their PR.
Why is that so important to them? Why is that kind of like their mantra?
I think it's a gesture to, you know, the Chinese government, the officials they're working with, and also the clientele that they're bringing in, who are very much influenced by this political system, which is by its nature wary of what they consider Western values and ideals and things like cultural imperialism. You know, companies like Disney coming over and setting up shop. So Disney, in the run-up to this opening, has made it very clear that they are willing to make concessions. They're willing to let the government call the shots, and that they see themselves as an equal or even a lesser partner in this whole operation.
You know, the reports from the opening day ceremony suggest not just the start of a new theme park, but something bigger, almost diplomatic. The CEO of Disney, Bob Iger, brought greetings from President Obama, who said the park captures the promise of the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and China. Is this more than an amusement park? What's going on?
I mean, on the ground, it feels like an amusement park, but no, it is something more. I mean, Walt Disney himself, the man himself, died in 1966. You know, at the first year of the Cultural Revolution, right? So much has changed since then. Clearly, you know, China has really emerged as a major player on the world stage, and I think the government wants to send this message that, yes, they've arrived, and yes, their door is open to the rest of the world, even if they're only willing to play by their own rules.
I got to ask you one last thing, Jonathan. Disney World, as you know, is so associated with Orlando and Orlando with Disney, but Orlando now signifies something also kind of terrifying. Was that at all in the air at this grand opening?
No, I mean, not for the Chinese guests that I spoke with. I'm sure Disney itself is feeling a bit of strain. You know, not only was there the shooting in Orlando, but also the gator that dragged a 2-year-old into the water near Disney World and killed this kid. So, you know, clearly Disney has a lot on its plate at the moment. You know, there's been a lot of tragedy, but I think for the typical sort of Chinese guest at the park, what's happening in the States right now isn't really on their radar. They just want to have a good time and provide a good experience to their kids.
Jonathan Kamen with the Los Angeles Times speaking with me from Shanghai. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you.
Here's a question that sounds a lot more philosophical than it really is. When is a tree not a tree? The short answer, when it's a coconut palm in the Indian state of Goa. Yes, in Goa, they are debating whether a coconut palm is a tree. State authorities late last year said it is not a tree, but now two organizations are suing to reverse that decision. Chavi Sachdev is a reporter in Mumbai and a friend of ours here at The World. Are people in India finding this a bizarre debate, Chavi?
Yes, because it's absolutely nuts. If it weren't actually happening, it would be terribly funny. But yeah, everyone is laughing, but we're also seriously appalled.
Yeah, so why did the state government of Goa reclassify the coconut palm?
So to understand that, we have to go back to 1984, when Goa ruled that to cut down trees over an area of 7/10 of a square mile in the whole year, you need permission from the tree authority. So you can't cut down your own trees, you need permission. The only exception is if a tree poses a threat to life and property. So the environment minister has gone on record to say that the farmers begged him to declassify the coconut because they wanted to cut them down and replant higher yield crops. A lot of people do not think that's really true. A lot of people, like Armando Gonzalez from Goa Forgiving, one of the two NGOs that sued the state, has a quite different opinion.
I think the government is clearly trying to play games with all of us. They are trying to say it's for the farmers and the benefit of the farmers. It's not. A real farmer would never cut a coconut tree. No Goan would do that unless you're a builder. So for a builder, it's blanket permission. Do what you want. Pick up the land and cut it.
So why would a Goan never cut down a coconut tree? Why is that such a sacred tree?
Well, it's really part of their identity. They use everything from the coconut tree quite thoroughly, from the fronds and the bark to the coconut shells. And of course, the coconut cream is part of their cuisine. I met Michael Gracious, who's a theater producer, and he summed it up for me. He said, there's a word in Konkani called Goan Karpond.
Goan Karpond is Goanness. It is incomplete without a coconut tree.
So it's all wrapped up in Goan identity, this one tree.
Absolutely. They're very proud of it. And it's also such an integral part of the environment as well as the vista. And it's everywhere. It's beautiful. And it also keeps the soil erosion down to a minimum.
Well, as we heard from Armando Gonsalves a moment ago from Goa for Giving, he suggested with the lifting of this protection of the coconut tree, builders are just going to cut them all down. Is that actually happening or is it just a fear?
It's happening. So in one of the places I went to, the villagers were protesting because 500 trees have been cut to make way for a distillery. And another place that the activists took me to, 150 trees had disappeared overnight, at night. And in its place were earth-moving equipment. And it was quite clear that this was for builders, not for the villagers who own these groves.
Yeah, and as you said, this is kind of laughable, but it's also serious stuff. And there have been big protests about the reclassification of the coconut palm. Petitions have been circulated. I gather there's even been songs written about the coconut palm. Here's one of them. Goa, goa, save coconut trees. Goa, goa, save your eyes. It's a nice song, Chavi. Is it working to change any opinions?
Well, there's been a lot of support from Goans who live all over the world trying to get the government to pay attention. But that's not going to change anything. The only thing that will change the amendment to the law is tackling it in a court of law.
And this week, a court did hear the challenge from the NGOs. What did they decide?
So they decided to decide in 6 months. But next month, they're going to reconvene to share an interim order, which will determine what happens until that hearing in 6 months. So as of now, anybody can cut the trees. Hopefully in July, the court will say that the NGOs have won and that the tree is indeed protected as it used to be.
I got to say, the story has gone global among botanists anyway. What was the reaction when Goa's environment minister said the coconut palm can't be a tree because it doesn't have branches?
Well, there was a lot of laughter. There was also suggestions that maybe it's a fern or something like that instead. So it's just been the butt of so many jokes.
Well, I remember you taking me to a wonderful Goan meal in Bombay. The food's so rich in coconut milk and meat, I can assure you it's not a fern.
Yeah, and the Goans would definitely agree.
Reporter Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Plenty of coconut palms in Puerto Rico, but that's not their big problem right now. Puerto Rico is facing a very scary deadline. A $2 billion payment on the territory's massive debt is due on July 1st. The government there says it can't pay, or rather that it has to choose between paying its creditors and keeping vital government services going. The World's Jason Margolis reports on some services that are already being hampered in Puerto Rico and have been for a while.
Jeanette Alicia Fernandez has a 10-year-old daughter with dyslexia and other learning disabilities. She flips through an overstuffed binder several inches thick with papers and plastic sleeves. These papers document her 4-year battle with the Puerto Rican government to get services for her daughter. She says it's been wasted time. Speaking in Spanish, Fernandez describes her daughter's struggles.
Se me frustra.
She constantly criticizes herself. She pulls her hair. She insults herself, saying that she is as slow as a turtle.
Her translator is Nelly Cosme, a mother of a 4-year-old daughter with autism. She's also been battling the Puerto Rican government to help her child.
In order for me to get a service, I would have to go to the district. The district would tell me, we'll call you. The call never comes. Then you go to the district again, and they would say, you need an appointment in order to go.
Cosme says eventually she got help for her daughter.
But you have to battle it out.
The two moms are also getting some help for their kids at this privately run center in San Juan for children with special needs. It's their lifeline. But soon it might not be an option. The staff hasn't been paid in a while. The center runs on government funds. And director Anitza Urquilla says those funds haven't arrived for some time.
8 months.
How do you keep it open?
With bank loans.
You're taking out bank loans. That's not normal, is it?
No.
It gets worse. The bank says it won't loan her any more money until the government starts paying her again. I asked her, what's she gonna do?
I don't know.
Puerto Rico's governor says his island is facing a humanitarian crisis. It's not just educational special services, it's healthcare too. Last week, for example, a medevac helicopter company said it was grounding its air ambulances in Puerto Rico until the government pays its bills. I asked Jaime Pla Cortez, executive president of the Puerto Rico Hospitals Association, if the island is facing a humanitarian crisis. His response, that's a tricky question.
When you have people that used to be able to get an appointment with the doctors in 2 weeks and now it's taking a month and a half, it begins to look like a humanitarian crisis. You know, it's not the kind where people are dying out of hunger.
Still, there are basic economic realities. He says people won't be denied life-saving treatment because of a lack of government funds. But consider a patient who needs a hip replacement.
To do a hip replacement, there are two things that need to happen. You need to have a good doctor to take care of that, and you need the hip part. And if you're not able to buy the hip part, then you're not going to be able to replace anything. And it may sound very simplistic, but that's what it comes to.
He hopes it won't come to that. But the Puerto Rican government has been struggling to fully fund its share of Medicare and Medicaid, which in turn pay doctors, hospitals, and other medical suppliers. Hospitals have laid off nurses and closed floors. Electricity was even cut off for a few hours at a hospital that couldn't pay its power bill. Victor Ramos, a pediatrician and president of the College of Physicians and Surgeons, says many doctors are simply leaving Puerto Rico.
We have 14,000 physicians in 2006. Now we have 9,000 physicians.
Most who leave are moving to the mainland United States. It's not hard to figure out why.
The salary in the United States is 3 to 4 times more.
The Secretary Director of Puerto Rico's Office of Budget and Management, Luis F. Cruz Batista, offers this blunt assessment of his island's finances.
We are running out of cash. Paying Paul one day and then pay John the other day, pay the security service one day, pay for the transportation.
Many on the island, though, aren't that sympathetic to the government's plight. Nellie Cosme, the mom with an autistic daughter, says Puerto Rican officials can't blame everything on the debt crisis. Remember, her daughter is an American citizen.
And the U.S. have been constantly saying, here are the funds, here are the funds, here are the funds. And they've been rerouting this money the entire time. Politicians have been rerouting this money. Politicians, they live better basically than anyone around here.
The Puerto Rican Department of Education has been plagued by long-standing accountability issues and corruption scandals. Money hasn't always reached the children. Cosme and other Puerto Ricans are angry with their government for ignoring their problems for years. They say politicians only talk about a humanitarian crisis now because they want the U.S. government to ease their debt burden. For The World, Jason Margolis, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. If you look at a map, south of China and Tibet, you see India, of course. But squeezed in between in the Himalayas is tiny Bhutan. It's a small kingdom known internationally mostly for its happiness index and for not allowing television until 1999. But for those involved in animal rights, it's known for something else. A successful nationwide effort to spay, neuter, and vaccinate Bhutan's large street dog population. Twig Mowat is co-founder of a dog rescue group called All Sato, and she's an editor for Bark magazine. Yes, there is a magazine about dogs called Bark. I know you got back from Bhutan recently, Twig, and when you were there, were you seeing a lot of stray dogs?
Actually, I was seeing a lot of stray dogs. You notice it as soon as you get off the plane. They're along the highways. They're in front of every business, in front of the gas station, the police station, hanging out by people's houses. You're stepping over them on the sidewalks. They're everywhere.
Are they menacing or friendly, and how do the Bhutanese relate to them?
Well, the Bhutanese, being largely Buddhists, believe that sentient beings should be cared for. So the Bhutanese are very good to the dogs. They're really community dogs. So there isn't a lot of individual pet ownership the way we would think of it. But they're dogs that sort of have loyalty to certain territory. They might be 7 or 8 that live on a certain block, and then the people who live in that area feed the dogs. So they do care for the dogs. Mm. They don't want to hurt them. They believe that would be bad karma for them.
I mean, despite this holistic relationship between the people and these stray dogs, it must have become a problem because Bhutan went on this nationwide effort to spay and neuter and vaccinate these dogs. So what prompted it?
The population was growing, and Bhutan has been developing its tourism industry. And it was getting a lot of complaints about barking dogs at night that were keeping the tourists up. And there were so many puppies being born that the puppies were being just slaughtered on the streets. So you're driving by dead puppies and, you know, nobody wants that. So they knew they had to do something, and they had tried culling and shooting and methods that are inhumane and that don't work. They just are not a long-term solution. They're sort of a Band-Aid approach. So in 2008, they were going to be coronating a new king, and they reached out to Humane Society International because they wanted the streets to be a little cleaner. And Bhutan had the idea that they wanted to put the dogs into big government pounds and just keep them sheltered that way. Humane Society International said that was a terrible idea. It was a terrible idea. Thousands of dogs died. Mm. And the Bhutanese also discovered that if you take away the dog population, they're very much part of the ecosystem there. You're really messing with Mother Nature. So the rats had moved in to replace the dog void, and they were just inundated with rats. So Humane Society International followed up with Bhutan. They said, look, we'll work with you on a spay-neuter program. We know this is the only thing that's going to work. It takes a little bit of time, but in the long run, it's going to be your most effective solution.
When things were at their worst, what was the population estimate of the stray dogs?
I don't really know. I think when HSI went in, they thought the dog population was maybe about 60,000. I think they revised that considerably upward, probably around 100,000.
For the whole country.
For the whole country.
Yeah.
And it's a small country, and it's largely centered in 4 urban areas. So it was a really big concentration in the cities.
I mean, that's a lot of dogs. How do
it
you go out and manage a spay and neuter program for a population that size?
Well, it was a huge effort. First, they didn't have enough vets. So Indian members of the Humane Society International sent in a vet team. They started training vets, vet techs, dog catchers. You have to know how to humanely catch these dogs. They use nets,
sure,
which is very humane, but it's not easy. These guys are real escape artists. They're biggish dogs. They're super smart. They work together.
Spaying and neutering, I think of as a fairly invasive procedure. What method do they use?
Yes. If you've grown up in the U.S., it has been. I mean, the motivation here has not been to make it fast. It's been to make it very safe and super clinical. So the programs they use in Bhutan, they're really kind of set up for mass units. The vets know how to make a tiny little incision, and when the incision is small, everything else is easier and faster. Mm. The recovery time is faster. The chance of infection is lower. They make a little incision. They go in. I liken it to a crochet hook, and they just, you know, grab out the stuff. They can do a spay in under 10 minutes, a neuter in under 5 minutes. And it's like watching just an artist. The stitches are done on the interior of the dog, so there's nothing for the dog to scratch. So the chance of post-surgical infection is really minimal.
Have enough Bhutanese vets been trained up that the program is run entirely by the Bhutanese
now?
It is
run entirely by Bhutanese now. I mean, I think there may be a little bit of HSI oversight, but that was always the goal, to transition it into a full Bhutanese program.
How many dogs have been reached since the program started in 2009?
Over 71,000 dogs.
Wow, that's incredible.
It is incredible. And the way you can recognize a dog that has been spayed or neutered is they take a little triangular notch out of its left ear. And I have to say, everywhere I went, I would hike up to some monastery in the hills or trekking along the rice paddies, and the dogs, every single dog I saw had this triangular notch. So,
is there a lesson in Bhutan with their spaying and neutering program here for the United States?
Well, I think here for the U.S., I think for the world, if I may say that. The fact that the government was fully on board was crucial. And having that enabled HSI to go in and do this complete program, and they're not done yet. You know, they're going to continue checking in and following up, because the real shift in the size of the population isn't going to be noticeable for probably another 5 or 6 years, because now the adult dogs that have been spayed and neutered are going to start dying natural deaths. And at that point, they'll have all these statistics in place so that they can show how effective this has been, and then they can present that evidence to governments that, you know, really want to see some facts before they sign on.
Twig Mowat is co-founder of All Sato Rescue. She's also the international humane editor for Bark magazine. She's been telling us about the efforts being made in Bhutan to deal with the stray dog population there. Twig, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
You can see photos of Bhutan's stray dogs hanging out, doing what strays do, also in nets after the dog catchers got them, and getting ready to be spayed and neutered. Those pictures are at PRI.org. Now from the land of happy dogs to the island of short-tailed cats. This is a trio Barul from the Isle of Man in the British Isles, home of the Manx. Barul takes their name after a sacred mountain on the island, and I'll say this about Barul, they just make gorgeous Celtic music. Cats from the Isle of Man, and that'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Hope you'll be with us tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.